All right. Well, I'll go ahead and get started at this point, and people can join as they will, and certainly everyone's going to have access to the download. So again, everyone, this is Clint, just making sure that you're on the right breakout call, the one that you've selected. If not, you know, feel free to jump off the line and jump on to either Zach or Nicole's, and you'll get download access for all three calls. So it's an honor to be here joining you guys today in our second set of calls for the Living Beyond Complexity series. And my series of breakout calls, you know, we'll see how they unfold over time. But generally speaking, we could say that they'll focus on how we may go about using the theoretical distinctions provided by the Integral Map to help us walk along this path towards second simplicity. So how can we use these maps to help us navigate, you know, more authentically, with greater integrity, with greater effectiveness and ease, if you will, toward this notion of a second simplicity, which, you know, we'll press into through several different facets of theoretical distinctions today, unpacking it from, you know, several different angles. But to start, let me just tell you where we're going to head today. We have an hour for the call. I'm going to begin by making just a series of five what I think are critical meta points. And I think these meta points are actually likely going to resurface in my breakout calls probably throughout the whole series. So we'll touch in with each, maybe even every time, just deepening them as we go or looking at them in relation to the other topics, you know, next month, ethics, beyond that, perspective taking, laughter, tears, generally, you know, don't remember the order of the concepts or the topics, but we'll look at each through the lens of these sort of five meta points. And the first, well, actually, let me tell you, after that, we'll head into looking at three theoretical distinctions, right? Structure stages, state stages, and what we're going to call stations. And we'll look at each of those three and how they view this general second simplicity spectrum, which we started off discussing last week. And when I say second simplicity spectrum, what we're basically talking about is that pattern of three. So the move from simplicity to complexity to simplicity again. So we'll call that our second simplicity spectrum. And in the second part of the call, we'll look at that spectrum through the lenses of structures, states, and stations. And then my hope is to leave 15, 20 minutes at the end for just questions or dialogue, check in with you guys, see where things are at, and we'll go from there. So I'm going to jump right into these meta points. I'm going to start by heading back to where we were last week. And in one really critical, really key line, Mark, in his beautiful opening, made a critical point in regards to this breakout call. And he said that theory is love, or theory is a form of loving. Now, that's the meta point of all meta points that can actually hold what we're going to do together in this series of breakout calls. But let's push into that a little bit, because it sounds kind of like two theory heads, me and Mark, and we could probably get Zach on board here as well, just trying to dress up our third-person abstract love of the maps by adding a little love into the mix, right? Now, I hope you can feel that most of us who dedicate as much energy and effort, you know, as we do into theory, and I think most of you probably relate to this, or otherwise you wouldn't be on this call, that you do it out of a love and out of a passion. But we're not really, when we say theory as love, referencing that. And we're not so much speaking about your desires or motivations. Rather, just to cut right to the heart of it, we're talking about a third person honoring and a third person oriented participation in the evolution of spirit. I'll pause on that for a second. And then I'll say it again. A third person honoring and participation with the unfolding of spirit. It's a third person way of kind of getting in there with the erotic or the erotic unfolding, right, of the cosmos. And you could liken it to, say, a distinction that you're all probably familiar with, the third person face of God. So when we say third person, obviously what we have behind there is a second person face of God, a first person face of God, and the second and first person ways of communing and participating with or being, you know, one with spirit. Theory happens to focus or fall more in that third person realm. So it's not the best, right? It may be what some of us choose to do with, spend more of our time doing, I should say, and that's perfectly fine, as long as we don't fall into any reductionisms or absolutisms. It's certainly the path that I've chosen, or that's chosen me. We could argue that it's the path that Ken chose, or that chose him. And again, you wouldn't be on this call if you don't have some, I'm guessing, overlap or resonance with that perspective. So theory as love is an active process of engaging that one really important, beautiful third-person face of God. Okay? And we can look at that just briefly through this lens of a second simplicity spectrum. So let's start with something that you all have heard, right? Integral maps, this set of five elements, quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types. They make up the aqual framework, or the integral framework, right? And you've heard the one just repeated over and over in most of the books and 8 years of working with Ken in this field and all the audios and all the videos, right? The map is not the territory, right? The one core teaching. I'm going to position that teaching in the second simplicity spectrum. So starting at the beginning. First, it's no map. We don't have a map. We don't need a map. We can't see a map. In a certain range of development, kind of technically before a third-person perspective-taking capacity comes online, right? Which comes online, generally speaking, about the orange altitude, right? You can think the modern, sort of rational, sort of early systems thinking sort of altitude or range of development. Prior to that, first and second-person perspectives dominate, and you really can't fully grasp the heart of what a third-person map, like Integral, is actually about. So we start with no map. And then we move, step two, to map. And it's at this realm of map, you know, which correlates with complexity, not surprisingly, that we find this core teaching of the map is not the territory. And here's the big question, right? Typically it just stops there. Typically we just continue to repeat ourselves about, let's learn the map, but always remember that the map is not the territory. What if we were to speculate, what if we were to hypothesize, what if we were to touch in with those moments in our experience where that didn't seem 100% true? And I don't mean in a reductionistic or confused way. Think about it in a paradoxical, sort of beautiful way. Have you ever experienced a time where the map was the territory, or there was no difference between the map and the territory it was describing? Because the aqual distinctions were arising in your awareness, helping you navigate your life as it was unfolding moment to moment. Map, territory, hard to tell what the distinction is. So I postulate that is our third move. That's the second simplicity in regards to this theoretical third person participation with the unfolding of spirit. So again, we start with no map, we go to map, and then back to a second no map. And again, as you know, we don't want to confuse level one and two, right? Yeah, pre-trans fallacy, we've heard about that stuff before, level one and three confusion. But even more to the point, from an awareness perspective, as a practice over this course of these calls, these breakout calls, I want to cultivate our ability to discern when we're moving toward one, toward level one, towards the first no map, the first simplicity, or when we're moving towards the second simplicity, the second no map, right? And also being able to kind of experientially experience what the difference is, okay? That's the first meta point, and as you can sense, we'll return to that as we go forward. Next, like I said last week, the second simplicity. I don't care how you want to slice it. I don't care if you're going to hear it from Mark's perspective, Zach, Nicole, mine. It's not easy. It's not easy. Reaching the second simplicity, however we conceive of it, does not mean easy. It doesn't mean simply graspable. It's not simplistic in the sense of simplicity, right? So as we make these moves toward the second simplicity, we're going to experience difficulty and confusion, right? And the third meta point flows right out of that, which is that all of us, generally speaking, both as individuals and particularly as a collective, as a culture, both as an integral community, an enlightenment community, a world spirituality community, but also just as a Western community around the globe, we are not at the place of experiencing or living the second simplicity. So what that then suggests, sort of as our third meta point, is that we're all moving there together. And that's what this discourse, our fourth sort of meta point or framing point, that's what this discourse that we're hoping to generate in this series of Living Beyond Complexity calls, that's what this discourse aims to help us move towards. Starting, you know, as individuals, joining together in this really small, and let's just say it, elite, this really small and elite collective, and then hopefully extending out to larger and larger collectives. And this doesn't mean that everybody has to learn the integral map. I mean, that's not how we extend this out to larger collectives. It's about learning the skills and capacities and practices to actually help us live beyond complexity, moving through complexity to something after it, and spreading that out in the work that we do, in the way that we love, in the way that we parent. So, what have I said here? Our fourth meta point is basically like, this is the growing tip, and it's a multi-year, multi-decade sort of investment. And y'all are invited to participate in that discourse. And that's really at the core of what we're doing here. And that's at the core of why Mark and I decided to do it in this way. Right, this kind of seemingly complex way, right, where there's four of us involved and we do a call with Mark and then we do these breakout calls and then a call with Mark and all of us sort of thrown in there together, all these various different perspectives, and you think you're confused now, right, wait until you download the three calls from that are happening right now. Okay, so we're all participating in this growing edge, this sophistication of the discourse. And in regards to that point that we're all not there, we're not living at a place of second simplicity, I think one possible way to alleviate that, to change that, to shift that, is to be really serious about this discourse. First, to just have it, to start it, right? So this is not, this goes back to the point, you know, second simplicity is not easy. This is not the telecourse, the three steps towards enlightenment. No, it's not at all. We could say maybe the 2,700 steps towards enlightenment, the really confusing and complex most of the time kind of steps towards enlightenment, but that's the discourse. That's the nature of this discourse until we together move toward discovering what the second simplicity is. And when I say discovering, it's not just marketing language. It really is a process of discovering this together. Right? And finally, as we move towards this bit on how we understand second simplicity through these theoretical perspectives, our fifth and final sort of meta point is that we're going to work to understand this notion of second simplicity as a metaphor. As a metaphor. And we could go on for 20, 30, 40 minutes about the nature, the notion of metaphor. I was checking in last night with Lakoff and Johnson's books on metaphors, right? Just totally amazing stuff, penetrating the deep archetypal, cultural, historical, you know, role that metaphors have played in social cultural unfolding. And we, you know, we can touch in on that at some other point. But when I say metaphor, I'm saying it in that deepest sort of sense, not just in the sense of like, you know, let's just compare this to that so we don't have to be precise. No, really. Understanding second simplicity as a metaphor will allow us to do this. It'll allow us to hold how we can possibly understand second simplicity through the lens of structure stages, through the lens of state stages, and through the lens of stations. As a metaphor, it allows us to hold all of those three together, right, in one sort of metaphorical, beautiful paradox. And I'd like to argue, and we can check in on this later and as we go, that if we can cultivate the ability to do that, and if we can cultivate the capacity to recognize, right, when we're doing that and when we're not, right? So when we're not would be when we're just trying to hang on every single word that's coming out of Clint's mouth or Mark's mouth because we have to. We just have to understand and make sense of every single thing. Okay, that's not holding it as a metaphor. That is being mired you know, we could say if it gets a little unhealthy in that second level of complexity. But one way to work with this is a simple shift beyond that just sort of perverse fascination with complexity and making sense of everything, with a tagline you've heard. We shift beyond that, and we just hold these, all these notions as a metaphor, cultivate the ability to see that. It's like we can start witnessing life, your life, my life, as it's arising. We can start witnessing it as sort of like a vibrant painting, like an improvisational painting, right? And as it unfolds, it's like, boom, over here we got some states stuff arising, and over here we have this structure stuff arising, and over here we have the station stuff arising, and that's you sort of orienting, right, yourself, navigating, making sense live in real time, using the integral map, these distinctions to help you. But as you're doing it, you're just holding it. You're kind of smiling at it. You're kind of laughing at it even, right? And that's one way we can just slip, boom, right into second simplicity, really at any point in time. So those are our five sort of meta points to frame this up, to start it out. And again, we're going to touch on those as we go forward. We'll just take a breath here. In the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to be pushing into these three theoretical distinctions. And we'll do this sort of through the lens of, or touching in with, what I was calling last week the sort of grandma koan. And I don't know if that'll work. We'll have fun with it together and see where it ends up. But this grandma koan, or this grandma, I don't want to call it a problem because I don't like calling grandmas problems. That's just sort of rude. But this grandma koan, it's a discussion that Mark and I had. It started, I don't know, about 8-9 months ago. And like I said last week, it never actually finished, which is another example of, here we go right now, sort of working with this discourse at the growing edge, sort of figuring this out, you know, as we go forward. And I don't remember the exact details. Maybe Mark will tell us next week. But the grandma koan was, he was talking about when he lived in Israel, and there was this woman. I think she was a neighbor. She was someone's grandma. She wasn't Mark's grandma, but she was. Let's say she was 90 years old. She was totally old and totally beautiful, and lived, you know, down the hall from Mark. And he would go over and he'd visit her and spend time with her once a week. And he did this for like years on end, right? And he just developed this massively beautiful, this massively deep sort of love affair with this woman. Just everything about her being. She was just captivating. She was fascinating. She was so deep, so present, so loving, so compassionate, so everything we could say that all of us, you know, want to be, want to embody in some sense. And the question then becomes, or the koan then emerges, that when we look at who that person was, right, through the lens of the integral map, we say, we might start to say, like, she... if she's not enlightened, I don't know what enlightenment is. Right? And of course, that brings up the notion of, well, what do we mean by enlightenment? And that itself is another series of like 20 calls. But as you know from the integral community, from Ken's writing, particularly in integral spirituality, in short, enlightenment is defined, integral enlightenment, as having two components. There's a component of vertical or structure stage development, which we'll get to more of in a moment. And there's a horizontal component of state stage development. But here's the koan. Our grandma, our beautiful deep being of a grandma, has never intentionally cultivated development in either of those spectrums. So what gives? How does she come off as showing up as so enlightened, but she's not, you know, even aware of, you know, Kohlberg's work in moral development, or Keegan's work in orders of consciousness, or anything with integral? And while she might be aware of states in some sense, she's not, you know, we're not talking about some devout monastic 30 years in the Zendo sort of cultivating state stage movement kind of person. And yet we see this profundity of beingness. So how do we make sense of it? And like all koans, I mean, they're basically designed to sort of be unsolvable, and what they require typically to break free or to break through is a shift in consciousness, a shift in state of awareness. So what we have here is just a koanic, if that's even a word, framing that holds this discussion about state stages and structure stages. Okay. So we could say from the structure stage perspective that our grandmother here is living, to say for the sake of argument, in a very deeply traditional ethnocentric culture. And she was living in Israel, so it's safe enough to say. Right? So we can't say then that she's such a developmental pioneer that she's moved, you know, one, two, three, at least six or seven stages beyond what the social cultural center of gravity is. Now we could possibly on the state side that, yeah, she's probably had, you know, some peak experiences of states beyond the waking realm for sure, and that contributes in a large way to how she shows up as being this deep being. But let's touch in with structure stages first. So second simplicity can be understood as referring to a macro developmental spectrum of levels of consciousness. So when I say levels, I'm referring to the all levels component of the integral map. But in this context, we're going to call them structure stages. Structure refers to their deep sort of patterns, and stages refers to the fact that they unfold sequentially. And that as they unfold sequentially, we can't skip structure stages. Now, there's any number of developmental lines, several dozen to be precise, all explored by different researchers, and we could look to any of them for an understanding of what this vertical spectrum of structure stages is. So there's altitude, which is sort of an amalgam of many of them. But altitude has quite a few distinctions, which we don't have time to fully get through in this call. So I'm going to work with just the two kind of simplest ones, which will give you a nice sense of this. Egocentric, ethnocentric, world-centric, cosmocentric. You guys have heard those ones before, I imagine. And when we say egocentric, we're talking about how far, how big, how developed is your sense of care and concern. When it's egocentric, it's only for yourself. When it's ethnocentric, like our grandma here, it extends to include those who you define as in your group. In your group based on race, religion, sex, any number of things, sports team, political affiliation. When it moves to world-centric, your care and compassion expands to include all humans, regardless of those group-based distinctions. And when it moves to cosmocentric, or the truly transpersonal structures, we see an expansion that includes all beings rather than just all humans. Right? So that's just to orient us. That's the spectrum of vertical development. That basically covers from birth to the highest places that humans have gotten. Okay? But we need something a little more precise. So let's look at that spectrum, the same spectrum, through the lens of how thinking operates. So thinking at this first level could be also called egocentric, right? So it works like this. There's one way to view something. There's one way to make sense of something. And you know what? It's my way. And your way doesn't even exist to me. My way of thinking about this, that, or the other thing is right, period. So we can all touch in with folks that are developed at that place, children, some adults who are struggling, and ourselves as we kind of slip into our little narcissistic games at times. Right? A step up from egocentric thinking, an actual huge developmental move, is absolutistic thinking. Absolutistic says two things. Either or, black or white. I see two options, right? But only one of them is right. Only one of them is correct. You accept Jesus as your savior, right? That's on one side. Now, I'll acknowledge that on the other side, there's all these people who don't accept Jesus as their Savior, but they're wrong. It's kind of sad. They're going to hell. That's absolutistic thinking, kind of stereotyped there, you know, just to make a point. It's absolutistic thinking, either or, both, not both and, right? Black and white. From there, we move to multiplistic thinking, right? Multiplistic thinking is the emergent of the orange altitude, what we're talking for about emergence of rationality and early systems thinking. And multiplistic thinking says, you know what, there's a whole range of potential right views, right? If we're trying to explain how people get sick and we think there's these things called bacteria that are involved and we're trying to discover this, there's many potential options for what could be right. But the quest of science, the quest of rationality is to look at all those options and determine which is best. That brings on the notion of like a meritocracy. Best. Not just fully right, but which is best. And we're going to use science primarily, rationality, thinking, deductive logic to figure that out. So, multiplistic. Many different options, but still one of which that is best. Then we moved pluralistic thinking. Right? Pluralistic, or we could also sometimes call it relativistic. Right? This is associated with postmodernism. This is associated with the green altitude. And it suggests that there are many different ways of possibly viewing any given situation. We could even say an infinite, possibly, number of ways, because everybody is grounded or situated in their cultural historical background. And we can't say that one is more right than any other, because to do so would be to marginalize. To do so would be to oppress. Right? All these views are important, and we're going to work to honor them all. Obviously, there's a beautiful, beautiful partial truth in there, one which led to egalitarianism, which led to toward the ending of slavery, which led toward the beginning of civil rights, the beginning of women's rights, the beginning of environmentalism. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. And it can go extreme, and it can get a little crazy, as you also probably are familiar with. Ken calls it boomeritis, and we can push into that at some other point. Beyond that, our last sort of wave of thinking would be integral thinking. And we'll just use that term broadly to refer to everything sort of beyond relativistic, pluralistic. And integral thinking says, yes, there's many different options, many different possibilities, many different perspectives, but we do have a couple mechanisms where we can determine how to rank in a specific context which one of those options is more right, more whole, a little bit better, right, than some other options. And we're going to use a number of mechanisms to do that. And it's always based on the context that we're in. So these aren't fully just across-the-board sort of universals, more contextually based. And sometimes we'll use levels of development to aid that ranking. Sometimes we'll work with quadrants. Sometimes we just use our intuitive sense, our intuition. You know, or you can say, I can honor your perspective on what we should do in regards to, say, an ethical violation at a corporation, but I got to go with my gut here. And I'm going to select, given all these variables I'm tracking, my perspective, my route through this ethical sort of issue as being, as containing more wholeness, less partiality. It's not right 100% across the board because it's me, right? That'd be slipping back down to the lower levels. But in this context, I'm going to select it and support it as more right. Okay. So it's just a brief tour of what we mean by structure stages. Okay. Second, simplicity, right? This spectrum of three, from simplicity to complexity to the second simplicity, understood through the lens of structure stages, suggests what? That second simplicity is somewhere up there, at least at those integral levels or higher. Right? Now, we say this is, to get to second simplicity, we have to move beyond complexity, and many of you are correctly probably thinking, wait a second, I've been doing integral for a long time, and I'm pretty integral on a good day as far as my developmental expression, and let me tell you, this is pretty complex. I haven't really feel like I'm moving beyond complexity at all. So again, yeah, we could push it a little bit higher if we wanted, and we could say that as far as how do we move towards this path of enlightenment? The second simplicity, as seen through structure stages, yeah, it's up there towards, we could call it third tier, we could call it post-integral, we could call it transpersonal. It's up there at the top. So from just this perspective of understanding second simplicity as a structure stage, then it's kind of pointless in some sense for us to engage in this discourse for 8 months, because it's like, come on, you guys know just as well as I know that we're not going to be moving our structure stage of development in 8 months. Research shows that it takes 5 to 7 years. So the good news for us is that second simplicity is not just about structure stages. And it's not exclusively to be understood through the lens of structure stages. So we have state stages. Okay. Now let's start with states first. So before we add the stages component, states, waking, dreaming, deep dreamless sleep. Okay, waking, often sometimes called the gross state, dreaming, the subtle state, and deep dreamless sleep, the causal state. Now, you've also heard of two other states that we sort of tack on to the end, that the traditions tack on to the end. And those states are different because they're ever-present. They're always, always present, ever-present. They're called witnessing and non-dual. Okay? So sometimes we work with three states, gross, subtle, causal. Sometimes we work with four, gross, subtle, causal, non-dual. And sometimes we work with all five, gross, subtle, causal, witnessing, what Ken will call turiya from the traditions, and non-dual, also called turiya-tita. Okay. Now, why am I saying that? I'm not going to go through all five or all three of those options, but just to kind of point it out, this is complexity here. Okay? So we're moving beyond it. We're moving through it. And it highlight, look, at some point with states, because people use different amounts of states. And someone can have a peak experience of oneness with the gross, subtle, causal, witnessing, or non-dual state at any point. And many of you have had profound peak experiences of these states, spiritual experiences, mystical experiences, becoming one with nature, becoming one with sort of the energetics of a personal interaction or a group interaction, right? Be subtle, emotionality, the energetics. The classical sort of Zen Buddhist meditation experience of the causal void or emptiness, right? A complete cessation of suffering and a cessation of the arising of phenomena, right? They actually, in the direct reports, it has a color. It looks, it feels, it is blue, black, right? It's a causal state from one tradition's lens. Witnessing is when you recognize, you step back from that causal, you push through it, and you recognize that there's one consciousness, one subject, the witness with the capital W, who witnesses the arising of every phenomena in the manifest realm, and that the number of witnesses or true selves in the cosmos is one. So it's not that there's Charles's witness and then Clint's witness. There's just the witness. And when we look out through the eyes of the witness, we're looking out through that one pair of eyes, witnessing the entire relative realm arising as an object of our awareness. And then the non-dual state is when that final subject-object dualism, that final subject-object split between the witness and all that the witness witnesses, right? When that dissolves, and it literally feels in some traditions, some practices, like a dissolution, like there's a tug, like a slight tension. People say it's located behind your sort of solar plexus heart area or sort of right behind your third eye. I experience it more personally, sort of behind my face. Right? And that's like the feeling of the witness. And when that dissolves, it pops into non-dual, where the absolute and manifest realms are not one, but they're not two, they're not both, and they're not neither. And it's an experience of radical non-separation beyond distinctions. Right? So those are our five states. And we can peak experience those from any structure of development. Someone who's egocentric can experience any of them. Someone who's integral can experience any of them. The difference, as we know, is the way that we come to make sense of those experiences. Because that sense-making process is driven by or filtered through our structure of development. Okay. So that's the state piece of it. When we add state stages to the end, what we talk about is the spectrum of unfolding, of development, right, in that state spectrum. But what's developing is not the states themselves. They've been around for a while. Babies have access to deep dreamless sleep. What's developing is your capacity for what we call wakefulness, with a capital W. Your capacity for having stabilized or always on sort of access to the phenomena disclosed in the various states. So that's not a peak experience. So we could all do a meditation right now, and many of us could get into causal, And then as soon as the call ended or the meditation ended, it would go away. Okay? The peak experience. State stage, reaching the, say, causal state stage, is saying that we've trained our awareness through various practices and injunctions from various traditions to have a stable access to those causal phenomena. And when we do this path of training in virtually any different tradition, what's the same is not the experiences that they provide, but it's the steps they go through. They generally start with gross, they go to subtle, they go to causal, then to witnessing, and then to non-dual. So those are the state stages. And when we understand second simplicity, right, through the lens of states, what we recognize is that any experience of, we could say causal, witnessing, or non-dual, oftentimes will feel like or bring us to what we might otherwise call this second simplicity, this living beyond complexity, this experience of some sort of freedom. Okay? So we also can understand that second simplicity as either a high state stage, you've developed your wakefulness toward it, or as a high peak experience of a state. And when we go back to our grandma, we can say, well, she probably hasn't outpaced her culture by 6 or 7 structures in the vertical spectrum, but she probably does have some sense making of this going on, right? She probably does have access to pretty stable access to subtle phenomena, and probably access beyond that. And that would account in many ways for a lot of the depth, a lot of the freedom, a lot of the enlightenment that we were ascribing to her. We're going to push to one last distinction here. And that's what we've been calling stations. Okay? So sorry they all begin with S. I know it's kind of confusing. It's hard to say. It's hard to keep track of. But stations, right? I think Mark will get into them as well as we go forward. But stations, as a reference point, for those of you who've studied in a room for many years, can be likened to what Ken has called fulcrums. Okay, so they are the developmental transitions between structure stages. Now, there's also developmental transitions between state stages. Ken happens to call those switch points. But the point here is that switch points and fulcrums both undergo a three-step movement, a three-station movement. And that's a movement from identification, where you're, let's work with structures, where you're, you know, sort of fused with, not necessarily in an unhealthy way, but identified with, whatever your perspective happens to be. If you're at red development, then you're fused with a red egocentric perspective. If you're at amber, well, maybe you're fused with an absolutistic perspective. But if you're integral, you're fused with the integral perspective, as we described it early. It works for you. You're identified with it. You're getting good traction in your life with it. But then that starts to break down for any number of reasons, and you move into a process of disidentification or differentiation. You know, I see this has worked for me, but God, it's not really working anymore, this absolutistic thinking. Why is it pissing off all of my friends? It seems to work at home, but when I go to work and I start spouting out these either-ors, you know, my colleagues look at me like I'm sideways, like something's wrong with me. And that might be the case if your workplace is more of a world-centric, multiplistic place. So you start to differentiate. And that's a painful process, typically. It can go healthy, it can go unhealthy, but generally speaking, it's a birthing process, a birthing into a next new higher wave of development. So as you make that shift, as you make that move, sometimes over the span of many years, you get to a place, the third phase, the third station of integration, where you sort of reorganize, you re-solidify at this new higher level, you reach down, you include, right, the capacities that you need from the previous level. That's the transcend and include thing you've heard about. Sometimes you transcend, move beyond, and negate or leave behind certain transitional things you don't need anymore, right? Like an egocentric moral perspective. When you're at world-centric moral perspective, you don't need the egocentric one. It's actually left behind, right? And that's all navigated in this third phase or third station of integration. If Mark does get into this, you'll hear him call these submission, separation, and sweetness. And this whole notion of stations, this is really where we get to the essence of second simplicity as a metaphor. Because what we're talking about here are just holy trinities, patterns of three that emerge through different scales, right, of investigation. Macro developmental scale looks at development over a lifespan, and a micro developmental scale that looks at development over minutes and hours. And this metaphor of stations also works with states and state stages. Right? So when we sort of grasp and hold structures next to states, next to stations, what we actually realize is that we have this sort of fractalized view, which, yes, will and should land with you as feeling complex and feeling like it evokes confusion. But again, back to our practice, our pointing out instruction here. If you're listening to this call, if you're on the call, if you've downloaded it, whatever, don't try overly to understand every aspect of every single thing that I'm saying. We'll get there. You'll get there. You have time. We can work it out. Right? This, what I'm saying, all of this is in 20, 30 minutes here is a product of years of working with Ken mostly on all of this. Right? So rather, pause for a moment. In your mind's eye, visualize this beautiful fractal, this third person, like, you know, fractals, right? If not, Google fractal and you'll see the fractal pictures. They're gorgeous, you know, snapshots of complexity and chaos. I mean, they actually make gorgeous artwork. Print them out, put them on your wall, right? That's one way to view this. And if you can find yourself just sitting there in reverence of all of this complexity, not trying to overly figure it out, what you might do is you might slip your state into a state of second simplicity. And it'll have a feeling component. Just vision it. You'll feel the freedom. I don't have to understand all this. I'll get there. I have faith. I have trust. But what I'm sitting here in reverence of is that God or spirit manifests in this relative realm, in this third person, radically complex and simultaneously beautiful way. And I'm just here encountering that beauty. No, this is a particular masculine kind of beauty. Not everybody's going to think this is beautiful. Probably wouldn't be listening to this call if you couldn't resonate at least some sense with what I'm saying. And if you can't at all, if you're like, God, this guy's nuts, he's talking about beauty of fractals. What about beauty of, like, you know, my partner? What about beauty of a flower? What about beauty of, hey, and I'll say, you can experience all that through a third-person perspective as well. Just one face of God. Right? And when it comes to this map, these integral distinctions, structure stages, state stages, stations, what good are they? Well, if we hold that place of beautiful reverence and we hold it as a practice, and if we slip out of it, we come back to it. Rather than always coming back to this desire to make sense of everything, we'll find that we're moving toward this second simplicity. We're moving toward a living beyond complexity. And as we do it, as we repeat it over time, it will have an effect on our capacity, basically, to use this map to walk through our lives in more loving and compassionate in more authentic ways. So let's leave it at that for now. And let me check the time here. About 13 or so minutes left on the clock. So yeah, let's leave it at that for now. And I'm going to invite those of you on the call to hit *6 on your phone. And that'll unmute you. And then we can discuss some of these points, ask a question, share a perspective. So I'll stop for now. I'll give you a moment to sort of think of a question and unmute your line. Hi, I heard somebody speak up. Can you come again?
Hi, I'm on the phone. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi, I can. Who's this?
This is Russ. Russ Feldman.
Russ, hey, how you doing, Russ?
All
yeah,
right.
Russ Feldman, from South Korea.
Great. From Korea, of course.
Oh, from South Korea, yeah. Not North Korea. They don't let you call into these conference calls from North Korea.
No problem.
So what's up? No, they won't. So what's up, Russ? How you doing?
Doing fine and enjoying this and the series as we're beginning it. Makes a lot of sense to me, and I'm just, really enjoying it.
Cool. Do you just wanted to share that? Or be the lone voice who's experiencing the making of sense? I sometimes confuse myself into thinking that I am making sense. Well, you know, Russ and I go back. We've kind of geeked out together in theory conversations for some time. So I'm glad you're here, Russ. Great
to
have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah. Right on. To anyone else? There's not too many people on the call, so don't feel like you're going to be stepping on someone's toes just to unmute and jump in with a question or a comment.
Just a comment, Clint, if I may.
Yeah, who's this?
This is Charles.
Oh, hey, Charles. You sounded far away.
Yeah, I'm on speakerphone here. Sorry. Can you hear me well?
Okay. Yeah, I can hear you. I just didn't recognize your voice.
Okay. Just wanted to make quite a few comments, but I'll just limit it to maybe one or max two. The first one is I'm so excited about this whole notion of second simplicity. Sometimes just a concept hits you and you resonate so deeply with it. I remember I was probably 18 years old way back when, and I first encountered, the American Transcendentalists. I think it was Thoreau at that time. And had a line at that time of my life that really hit me. He once said that life is littered away by details. Simplify, simplify. And that sort of caught me right there. And that sort of lived with me, maybe at a first simplicity level, I would believe, because since then I've become sufficiently screwed up in complexity, you know, and, enjoyed the game and the play. But now the second simplicity is something of a holy ground that I feel, you know. I love the way that you called it beautiful and the fractal beauty sort of arising and playing itself out, right? I really, really, really like that, and reminded me of what I think Ken wrote in Integral Spirituality in his trivial play with the intelligent design people, right? Or creation is as much as it's beautiful and what have you, it's less of an intelligent design. He called it an artistic allure, right? And I really like that, because that does not rob the whole aspect of this arising of this dynamic of play, right? There's this element of play and surprise and wonder and all that entails, which we would lose on if it were some of this engineering type of precision design. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally hear you. I feel that there's actually so much of that buried right in so much of Ken and others writing, but particularly with Ken, because it's so, you know, it's supposed to be about theory. I mean, we got so much to learn here, you know. We experience it, you know, those passages, those beautiful when we read them. and then we can drop into that space. But it's amazing, and maybe I'm just, this is just my experience, and that's fine if it is. But and then we're so quickly, so easy to step out of those and back to the learning his next, you know, complex point. And I think, yeah, it's like a treasure hunt going through a lot of that writing to see the points where he and others have pointed out, you know, this, what we've just been calling here second simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the practice, right, for this week, the practice for us, the practice for this sort of breakout call session, you know, would be just the cultivation of, it's a simple practice, just the cultivation of space to just stand or sit or witness that beauty and with reverence and bow to it. Pause just 10 seconds longer when you encounter it. You know, seems simple, but that's a practice. Do it, all of us. See if we can expand, is add 10 more seconds, you know, to when we encounter something that we feel or resonate as embodying the second simplicity. Someone posted an Oliver Wendell Holmes quote on my Facebook page yesterday. And, of course, I'm not very good at Facebook, so I'm actually, like, on the site looking for this quote, and I don't remember how to use Facebook so well. How do I get to my wall? Let's see, where's that quote? It's a gorgeous quote. Well, I'll try to just recall it. It's Oliver Wendell Holmes saying something like, I don't give a fig for the simplicity that comes before complexity, but I'd give my life for the simplicity that lies beyond it. I mean, like, we're almost verbatim. I was, like, shocked. I'm like, oh, no, the estate is going to sue us for stealing his marketing. No, but I'd never seen it. I'd never encountered it. Like, what a treasure. I mean, that's, like, the same language we're using here, you know? Like, I really think these patterns of three, like fractals, they're like strange attractors, that they literally are the deep cosmic patterns, and that we can go on these treasure hunts of sorts, noticing and in reverence of where these patterns of three have just sort of popped up throughout the ages.
You know, for me too, as we talk, the things that really have struck me, one of them was this first person, second person, and the third person. Theory is love and this unfolding of the spirit in the third person, which the fractals, I think you're saying, is a metaphor for that. Has really struck me. I think there's really something, what you're just saying, cultivation of space. I think, is that third person space you're talking about?
Space is a tricky one to associate. I mean, a lot of people will say, no, space is like first-person meditation. But I actually view it in more of a third-person way, which is, I think, is where you're heading to it. And like a fractal is a perfect metaphor. I mean, like, the thing is basically, it's all math-based. I mean, it's derived through these massive, you know, organic calculations done by both humans, but also produced by the cosmos and shells and flowers and all those, you know, those things that you hear about, the golden ratio and whatnot. But fractals, you know, in that sense of, they were turned into art because people naturally said, wow, this is gorgeous. And again, Google them and you can look at them for hours. And literally could. And,
another comment I wanted to make.
Yeah, go for it. Please do.
Comment I just wanted to ask about was, you know, we're talking a lot about this in terms of our own internal personal movement into second simplicity, the identification and disidentification, integration. And I work a lot with groups, and I imagine a group itself can do that too, can't it? You know, move along these three.
Yeah. 100%. And you nailed it when you brought that. You brought it to. This is where the map can help, right? You brought it to the notion of stations. You said disidentification, or identification, disidentification, integration. Now, groups don't experience the structure stages and state stages in the way that I described it on this call. At some other point, we likely will get there. We can talk about how those two distinctions show up with groups, structures, and states. But stations, because it already is a sort of this metaphor, yes, you totally can see those in groups. right? And even some of the group process literature. I'm thinking like storming, norming, and conforming. I got those out of order probably, but and I'm also not remembering who the theorist was who presented it. Mm-hmm. But the notion of group dynamics and group process, you can mm-hmm. see the parallels.
Because I've been using,
you can see the parallels of group process. Right?
Right. I've been using a lot of Theory U, Otto Scharmer
mm-hmm.
Theory U, and I just recognize.
Well, Theory U is actually all about states.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Theory U is all about states. What Otto's doing there is he's developed both a theoretical frame and a group process for getting groups into causal spaces. That's what, he doesn't describe it like that. But, you know, we've talked to him and using the integral language. Like, he's bringing people from gross to subtle into causal, the bottom of the U, and then back out into subtle and into gross. And when you come back out from that ground, right, which you're experiencing as a shared ground, because it is a shared ground, but you're also doing it in a group. When you come back out, you know, it's where you can come out with, like, deeper, deeper intuitions about solutions to problems. And that's why the U process is so... I guess widely acclaimed, I guess is one way to put it, because it's harnessing those states. And I think it could then be understood to be guiding people through sort of in these stations of identifying, of disidentifying, of integrating, kind of around a problem or around a shared vision
mm-hmm.
or whatever the group happens to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I'm pointing at when I say this isn't easy, right? This is a metaphor. We're not there individually or collectively, and here's the discourse. So this is for you to take forward into, you know, your work the next time you're with a group. And then you come back and you tell us later how you think this fits. And then that's really how this is co-creative. And it's how we're moving this discourse up and forward, beyond. And, I imagine at some point, we'll have a better answer for a lot of these things. And what I mean by that is, it's nothing about us. It's about our maps will get more, sophisticated, more accurate. We'll grow them. We'll expand them.
If I may make a comment.
So not to turn it back on you, but.
Yeah. Or if I may make a comment here. Please.
Well.
Just for.
Please do jump in.
Okay. He mentioned the group dynamic as sort of. And you mentioned Sherman's aspect of his work as being focused more on states, all the way down to causal and bringing them back. I think I remember encountering something in Penn's work, The Integral Spirituality, where he says that he takes issue with group dynamics who want to people who study groups and want to turn it to sort of or make it parallel. Development with individuals, but he says that that's different from
mm-hmm.
Individual dominant monad. I think he quotes Leibniz there a bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
That individuals have dominant monads, but groups have what he calls nexus agency, I believe, right? And I'm not sure.
What you're talking about, I mean, this is where now we're deep into complexity, but this is another core truth. Let me try to distill it really clearly, but you've nailed it. I mean, that is what he does. That is where he takes issue, and he does it most in the excerpts to Volume 2, which if anyone emails me, if they don't have them, I can send those to you. But what you're talking about here is that it's a difference between individual and social holons, the difference between individuals and groups. And to sum it up, just as nuggets, right, if I were to get up right now out of my chair at my desk, on this call and walk across the room, my liver would go with me. It doesn't have a choice. It couldn't stay back and like hang out at the desk, right? Because I have a dominant monad, and the term is from Leibniz, right? That dominant monad exerts control over my parts. My parts are, one of them is my liver, so it'd go with me. Now, same metaphor. Stick with me on this. If I, Clint, get up, walk from my desk across the room, will I take any one of you with me? We're a social holon right now. We're a group doing a conference call. Even if you're downloading it, listening to it, you're in this space, this shared space. If I get up and go across the room, of course you guys aren't walking with me. I don't control you. And that's because a group doesn't have what we call a dominant monad or a central agency. Rather, they have a nexus. Nexus meaning network. Nexus meaning shared. They have a shared agency. So what a group can do is influence its members, not parts, right? Charles here on the call is not, you can't liken him to my liver. He's not a part of this social hold-on. He's a member of it. And he's a member who has his own consciousness. So I can influence, we can influence each other, and our shared intersections, they do exert influence on each other. Okay, so think about this from a legal perspective, usually where it lands for people. All right, so let's say we all live in the same city, and that city has laws. We all voted on those laws, and one of the laws is you don't drive 85 miles per hour in a school zone where the speed limit is 25 miles an hour. And if you do that, you know, you will face repercussions, jail time, fines, etc. Right? That law is an example of that influence of a nexus agency. And it actually does influence your behavior, because you will think twice, and if you don't do it the first time, after you get put in jail, you'll think twice the next time, about speeding, you know, when you drive. Right, so that's one example of the influence. And groups have that, but they don't control their members. And where Ken takes issue is anytime any theorist, I don't care if it's philosophy or if it's group dynamics or if it's, he really goes after the ecology folks, right? He takes issue when anybody postulates or suggests that groups have more influence or tending toward control than they actually do. So when we push into, in other calls, with how second simplicity and these three lenses show up in groups, we can push further into those distinctions between individual and social hold-on. It's a deep, deep, deep area. It's exciting. It's confusing. But it's also not something we can go into much more, whether 5 minutes over time here. But let's bring it back up for sure.
Okay, thanks.
So with that, I'm going to honor our time commitment sort of across the board the best of my ability. And I'm showing 5 after the hour. So I want to thank everybody for taking part in this call. I want to invite you to, again, join us all next week, next Thursday, same time. All of us will be together on the call. I'll also be sending out an email reminder to everybody tonight or tomorrow that'll have access links for downloading this call and the other breakout calls with Zach and Nicole. And we'll do this again on next Thursday. Thanks, everybody, for being here. It's been a pleasure and an honor, and I wish you all a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Clint.
Yeah, take care.
Okay, take care, guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.